Zarin looked on, composed and indifferent. She waited a few seconds after Mr. Niazi's outburst before saying calmly, "I seem to be confronting two prosecutors. Now, if you please, may I resume?" She threw a dismissive glance towards Mr. Farzan's corner. "I would like to remind the prosecutor and the jury of the quotation we were given at our first discussion of this book from Diderot's Jacques le Fataliste, who said, 'To me, the freedom of the author's style is almost the guarantee of the purity of his morals.' We also discussed that a novel is not moral in the usual sense of the word. It can be called moral when it shakes us out of our stupor and makes us confront the absolutes we believe in. If that is true, then Gatsby has succeeded brilliantly. This is the first time in class that a book has created such controversy. Gatsby is being put on trial because it disturbs us. At least some of us," she added, triggering a few giggles. "This is not the first time a novel, a non-political novel, has been put on trial by a state." She turned, her ponytail turning with her. "Remember the famous trials of Madame Bovary, Ulysses, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Lolita? In each case, the novel won, but let me focus on a point that seems to trouble His Honor the judge as well as the prosecutor, the lure of money and its role in the novel. It is true that Gatsby recognizes that money is one of Daisy's attractions. He is, in fact, the one who draws Nick's attention to the fact that in the charm of her voice is the jingle of money. But this novel is not about a poor young charlatan's love of money." She paused here for emphasis. "Whoever claims this has not done his homework." She turned almost imperceptibly to the stationary prosecutor to her left, then walked to her desk and picked up a copy of Gatsby. Holding it up, she addressed Mr. Farzan, turning her back on Niazi, and said, "No, Your Honor, this novel is not about the rich are different from you and me. Although they are, so are the poor, and so are you, in fact, different from me. It is about wealth, but not about the vulgar materialism that you and Mr. Niazi keep focusing on." "You tell him," a voice said from the back row, and I turned around. There were giggles and murmurs. Zarin paused, smiling. The judge, rather startled, cried out, "Silence! Who said that?" Not even he expected an answer. "Mr. Niazi, our esteemed prosecutor," Zarin said mockingly, "seems to be in need of no witnesses. He apparently is both witness and prosecution, but let us bring our witnesses from the book itself. Let us call some of the characters to the stand. I will now call to the stand our most important witness. Mr. Niazi has offered himself to us as a judge of Fitzgerald's characters. But Fitzgerald had another plan. He gave us his own judge, so perhaps we should listen to him. Which character deserves to be our judge?" Zarin said, turning towards the class. "Nick, of course. And you remember how he describes himself. He says, 'Everyone suspects himself of at least one of the cardinal virtues, and this is mine. I am one of the few honest people that I have ever known.' If there is a judge in this novel, it is Nick. In a sense, he is the least colorful character because he acts as a mirror. The other characters are ultimately judged in terms of their honesty, and the representatives of wealth turn out to be the most dishonest. Exhibit A, Jordan Baker, with whom Nick is romantically involved. There is a scandal about Jordan that Nick cannot at first remember. She had lied about a match, just as she would lie about a car she had borrowed and then left out in the rain with the top down. Nick tells us she was incurably dishonest. She wasn't able to endure being at a disadvantage, and given this unwillingness, I suppose she had begun dealing in subterfuges when she was very young in order to keep that cool, insolent smile turned to the world and yet satisfy the demands of her hard, jaunty body. Exhibit B is Tom Buchanan. His dishonesty is more obvious. He cheats on his wife, he covers up her crime, and he feels no guilt. Daisy's case is more complicated because, like everything else about her, her insincerity creates a certain enchantment. She makes others feel they are complicit in her lies because they are seduced by them. And then, of course, there's Mayor Wolfsheim, Gatsby's shady business partner. He fixes the World Cup. Nick writes, "It never occurred to me that one man could start to play with the faith of 50 million people with the single-mindedness of a burglar blowing a safe." So the question of honesty and dishonesty, the way people are, and the way they present themselves to the world, is a sub-theme that colors all the main events in the novel. And who are the most dishonest people in this novel, she asked again, focusing on the jury. "The rich, of course," she said, making a sudden turn towards Mr. Niazi. "The very people our prosecutor claims Fitzgerald approves of. But that's not all. We're not done with the rich." Zarin picked up her book and opened it to a marked page. "With Mr. Carraway's permission," she said, "I should like to quote him on the subject of the rich." Then she began to read. "They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together, and let other people clean up the mess they had made." "So you see," said Zarin, turning again to Mr. Farzan, "this is the judgment the most reliable character in the novel makes about the rich. The rich in this book represented primarily by Tom and Daisy, and to a lesser extent Jordan Baker, are careless people. After all, it's Daisy who runs over Myrtle and lets Gatsby take the blame for it without even sending a flower to his funeral." Zarin paused, making a detour around the chair, seemingly oblivious to the judge, the prosecutor, and the jury. "The word careless is the key here," she said. "Remember when Nick reproaches Jordan for her careless driving? And she responds lightly that even if she's careless, she counts on other people being careful? Careless is the first adjective that comes to mind when describing the rich in this novel. The dream they embody is an alloyed dream that destroys whoever tries to get close to it. So you see, Mr. Niazi, this book is no less a condemnation of your wealthy upper classes than any of the revolutionary books we have read." She suddenly turned to me and said with a smile, "I am not sure how one should address a book. Would you agree that your aim is not a defense of the wealthy classes?" I was startled by Zarin's sudden question, but appreciated this opportunity to focus on a point that had been central to my own discussions about fiction in general. "If a critique of carelessness is a fault," I said, somewhat self-consciously, "then at least I am in good company." This carelessness, a lack of empathy, appears in Jane Austen's negative characters, in Lady Catherine, in Mrs. Norris, in Mr. Collins or the Crawfords. The theme recurs in Henry James's stories and in Nabokov's monster heroes, Humbert, Kimbot, Van and Ada Wynne. Imagination in these works is equated with empathy. We can't experience all that others have gone through, but we can understand even the most monstrous individuals in works of fiction. A good novel is one that shows the complexity of individuals and creates enough space for all these characters to have a voice. In this way, a novel is called democratic. Not that it advocates democracy, but that by nature it is so. Empathy lies at the heart of Gatsby, like so many other great novels. The biggest sin is to be blind to others' problems and pains. Not seeing them means denying their existence. I said all this in one breath, rather astonished at my own fervor.
Yes, said Zarin, interrupting me now.
Could one not say, in fact, that this blindness or carelessness towards others is a reminder of another brand of careless people? She threw a momentary glance at Niazi as she added, those who see the world in black and white, drunk on the righteousness of their own fictions. And if, she continued with some warmth, Mr. Farzan, in real life, Fitzgerald was obsessed with the rich and with wealth, in his fiction he brings out the corrupt and decaying power of wealth on basically decent people like Gatsby, or creative and lively people like Dick Diver in Tender is the Night. In his failure to understand this, Mr. Niazi misses the whole point of the novel. Niazi, who for some time now had been insistently scrutinizing the floor, suddenly jumped up and said, I object.
To what exactly do you object?
Said Zarin with mock politeness. Carelessness is not enough, he shot back. It doesn't make the novel more moral. I ask you about the sin of adultery, about lies and cheating, and you talk about carelessness? Zarin paused and then turned to me again. I would now like to call the defendant to the stand. She then turned to Mr. Niazi and with a mischievous gleam in her eyes said, would you like to examine the defendant? Niazi murmured a defiant no. Fine. Ma'am, could you please take the stand? I got up rather startled and looked around me. There was no chair. Mr. Farzan, for once alert, jumped up and offered me his. You heard the prosecutor's remarks, Zarin said, addressing me. Do you have anything to say in your defense? I felt uncomfortable, even shy and reluctant to talk. Zarin had been doing a great job, and it seemed to me there was no need for my pontifications. But the class was waiting, and there was no way I could back down now. I sat awkwardly on the chair offered me by Mr. Farzan. During the course of my preparations for the trial, I had found that no matter how hard I tried, I could not articulate in words the thoughts and emotions that made me so excited about Gatsby. I kept going back to Fitzgerald's own explanation of the novel.
That's the whole burden of this novel, he had said.
The loss of those illusions that give such color to the world so that you don't care whether things are true or false as long as they partake of the magical glory. I wanted to tell them that this book is not about adultery, but about loss of dreams. For me, it had become of vital importance that my students accept Gatsby on its own terms, celebrate and love it because of its amazing and anguished beauty. But what I had to say in this class had to be more concrete and practical. You don't read Gatsby, I said, to learn whether adultery is good or bad, but to learn about how complicated issues such as adultery and fidelity and marriage are. A great novel heightens your senses and sensitivity to the complexities of life and of individuals and prevents you from the self-righteousness that sees morality in fixed formulas about good and evil. But ma'am, Mr. Niazi interrupted me, there is nothing complicated about having an affair with another man's wife. Why doesn't Mr. Gatsby get his own wife? He added sulkily. Why don't you write your own novel? A muffled voice cracked from some indefinable place in the middle row. Mr. Niazi looked even more startled. From this point on, I hardly managed to get a word in. It seemed as if all of a sudden, everyone had discovered that they needed to get in on the discussion. At my suggestion, Mr. Farzan called for a 10-minute recess. I left the room and went outside, along with a few students who felt the need for fresh air. In the hall, I found Mahtab and Nasreen deep in conversation. I joined them and asked them what they thought of the trial. Nasreen was furious that Niazi seemed to think he had a monopoly on morality. She said she didn't say she'd approve of Gatsby, but at least he was prepared to die for his love. The three of us began walking down the hallway. Most of the students had gathered around Zarin and Niazi, who were in the midst of a heated argument. Zarin was accusing Niazi of calling her a prostitute. He was almost blue in the face with anger and indignation and was accusing her in turn of being a liar and a fool. What am I to think of your slogans claiming that women who don't wear the veil are prostitutes and agents of Satan? You call this morality, she shouted. What about Christian women who don't believe in wearing veils? Are they all, every single one of them, decadent floozies? But this is an Islamic country, Niazi shouted vehemently, and this is the law, and whoever... The law, Vida interrupted him. You guys came in and changed the laws. Is it the law? So was wearing the yellow star in Nazi Germany. Should all the Jews have worn the star because it was the blasted law? Oh, Zarin said mockingly, don't even try to talk to him about that. He would call them all Zionists who deserved what they got. Mr. Niazi seemed ready to jump up and slap her across the face. I think it's about time I used my authority, I whispered to Nasreen, who was standing by, transfixed. I asked them all to calm down and return to their seats. When the shouts had died down and the accusations and counter-accusations had more or less subsided, I suggested that we open the floor to discussion. We wouldn't vote on the outcome of the trial, but we should hear from the jury. They could give us their verdict in the form of their opinions. A few of the leftist activists defended the novel. I felt they did so partly because the Muslim activists were so dead set against it. In essence, their defense was not so different from Niazi's condemnation. They said that we needed to read fiction like The Great Gatsby because we needed to know about the immorality of American culture. They felt we should read more revolutionary material, but that we should read books like this as well to understand the enemy. One of them mentioned a famous statement by Comrade Lenin about how listening to Moonlight Sonata made him soft. He said it made him want to pat people on the back when we needed to club them, or some such. At any rate, my radical students' main objection to the novel was that it distracted them from their duties as revolutionaries. Despite, or perhaps because of the heated arguments, many of my students were silent, although many gathered around Zarin and Vida, murmuring words of encouragement and praise. I discovered later that most students had supported Zarin, but very few were prepared to risk voicing their views, mainly because they lacked enough self-confidence to articulate their points as eloquently, I was told, as the defense and the prosecutor. Some claimed in private that they personally liked the book. Then why didn't they say so? Everyone else was so certain and emphatic in their position, and they couldn't really say why they liked it. They just did. Just before the bell rang, Zarin, who had been silent ever since the recess, suddenly got up. Although she spoke in a low voice, she appeared agitated. She said sometimes she wondered why people bothered to claim to be literature majors. Did it mean anything? She wondered. As for the book, she had nothing more to say in its defense. The novel was its own defense. Perhaps we had a few things to learn from it, from Mr. Fitzgerald. She had not learned from reading it that adultery was good, or that we should all become shysters. Did people all go on strike or head west after reading Steinbeck? Did they go wailing after reading Melville? Are people not a little bit more complex than that? And are revolutionaries devoid of personal feelings and emotions? Do they never fall in love or enjoy beauty? This is an amazing book, she said quietly. It teaches you to value your dreams, but to be wary of them also, to look for integrity in unusual places. Anyway, she enjoyed reading it. And that counts too, can't you see? In her can't you see, there was a genuine note of concern that went beyond her disdain and hatred of Mr. Niazi. A desire that even he should see, definitely see. She paused a moment and cast a look around the room at her classmates. The class was silent for a while after that. Not even Mr. Niazi had anything to say. I felt rather good after class that day. When the bell rang, many had not even noticed it. There had been no formal verdict cast, but the excitement most students now showed was the best verdict as far as I was concerned. They were all arguing as I left them outside the class, and they were arguing not over the hostages or the recent demonstrations or Rajavi and Khomeini, but over Gatsby and his alloyed dream.
19.
Our discussions of Gatsby for a short while seemed as electric and important as the ideological conflicts raging over the country. In fact, as time went by, different versions of this debate did dominate the political and ideological scene. Fires were set to publishing houses and bookstores for disseminating immoral works of fiction. One woman novelist was jailed for her writings and charged with spreading prostitution. Reporters were jailed, magazines and newspapers closed, and some of our best classical poets, like Rumi and Omar Khayyam, were censored or banned. Like all other ideologues before them, the Islamic revolutionaries seemed to believe that writers were the guardians of morality. This displaced view of writers ironically gave them a sacred place, and at the same time, it paralyzed them. The price they had to pay for their new preeminence was a kind of aesthetic impotence. Personally, the Gatsby trial had opened a window into my own feelings and desires. Never before, not during all my revolutionary activities, did I feel so fervently as I did now about my work and about literature. I wanted to spread this spirit of goodwill, so I made a point the next day of asking Zarin to stay after class to let her know how much I had appreciated her defense. I'm afraid it fell on deaf ears, she said somewhat despondently. Don't be so sure, I told her. A colleague passing me 2 days later in the hall said, I heard shouts coming from the direction of your class the other day. Imagine my surprise when instead of Lenin versus the Imam, I heard it was Fitzgerald versus Islam. By the way, you should be thankful to your young protégé. Which one? I asked him with a laugh. Mr. Bahri, he seems to have become your knight in shining armor. I hear he quieted down the voices of outrage and somehow convinced the Islamic Association that you had put America on trial. The university was going through many rapid changes in those days, and bouts between the radical and Muslim students became more frequent and more apparent. How is it that you have sat idle and allowed a handful of communists to take control of the university? Khomeini reprimanded a group of Muslim students. Are you less than them? Challenge them, argue with them, stand up to them and express yourselves. He went on to tell a story, as he so often did, a parable of sorts. Khomeini had asked a leading political cleric, Modarres, what he should do when an official in his town decided to call his two dogs Sheikh and Sayyid, a clear insult to clerics. Modarres's advice, according to Khomeini, had been brief and to the point. Kill him. Khomeini concluded by quoting Modarres, "You hit first and let others complain. Don't be the victim and don't complain." 20. A few days after the Gatsby trial, I hastily gathered my notes and books and left the classroom somewhat preoccupied. The aura of the trial still dominated the class. Some students had waylaid me in the halls to talk about Gatsby and present their views. There were even two or three papers written voluntarily on the subject. Stepping outside into the gentle light of the late afternoon sun, I paused on the steps, drawn by a heated argument between a handful of Muslim students and their Marxist and secular opponents. They were gesticulating and shouting. I noticed Nasreen standing a little apart from the crowd, listening to their arguments. Soon, Zarin, Vida, and a friend of theirs from another class joined me. We were all standing there idly observing the show, making desultory comments when Mr. Bahri came out the door with a purposeful frown. He paused for a moment, hovering beside me on the white steps. His gaze followed mine to the intersection of the argument. He turned to me with a smile and said, "Nothing unusual, they're just having a bit of fun," and left. I stood there somewhat stupefied with Zarin and her friends. As the crowd dispersed, Nasreen remained alone and hesitant, and I beckoned for her to join us. She walked shyly towards our group. It was a mild afternoon. The trees and their shadows seemed to be engaged in a flirtatious dance. Somehow my students got me talking about my own student days. I was telling them about American students' idea of protest. Boys with long hair streaking across the quad. After I finished my stories, there was some laughter, followed by silence, as we returned to the scene in front of us. I told them that perhaps my best memories were of my professors. In fact, I laughed. Four of my very favorites were Dr. York, who was conservative, the revolutionary Dr. Gross, and Dr. Veeley and Dr. Elkonin, both liberals. Someone said, "Oh, professor." They called me professor. It sounded even stranger to me then than it does now. You would have liked Professor R, who taught in our department until very recently. One or two students had not heard of him. Some knew of him, and one had been to his classes a few times. He was a professor at the Faculty of Fine Arts, a well-known and controversial film and theater critic and writer of short stories. He was what one would call a trendsetter. At 21, he had become the literary editor of a magazine, and in a short time, he and a few of his friends had made many enemies and admirers among the literary set. It seemed that now, in his late 30s, he had announced his retirement. Rumors were circulating that he was writing a novel. One of the students said that he was moody and unpredictable. Zarin's friend corrected him. He was not moody, just different. Another, with a flash of insight, turned to me and said, "You know, Professor, he's one of those people who have a knack for becoming legendary." I mean, they cannot be ignored. The legend was that he set no time limits for his classes, that a class could start at 3 in the afternoon and continue for 5 or 6 hours. The students had to stay for as long as it continued. Soon his reputation spread, especially among those interested in film. Many from other universities, despite the threat of penalization, sneaked out of their classes to attend his. They were not allowed into the University of Tehran without a student ID card, but by now participating in his classes had become a challenge. The most dedicated and rebellious jumped over the fences to escape the guards at the entrance. His lectures were always crowded. Students sometimes had to stand for hours just to get in. He taught drama and film, Greek theater, Shakespeare, Ibsen and Stoppard, as well as Laurel and Hardy and the Marx Brothers. He loved Vincent Minnelli, John Ford and Howard Hawks. I registered these stories unconsciously and put them aside for later. Years later, when he gave me as a birthday present videotapes of The Pirate, Johnny Guitar, and A Night at the Opera, I would remember that day on the steps of the university. Vida asked me if I had heard about his latest stunt before he was expelled. He left before he could be expelled, another student corrected her. I had not heard anything about his departure, I said, including this stunt, as she put it. But after I heard the story for the first time, I was always eager to repeat it to any sympathetic listener. When I knew him, my magician, much later, I forced him to tell and retell it to me many times. One day, the radical students and faculty members in the drama department at the Faculty of Fine Arts convened to change the student curriculum. They felt certain courses were too bourgeois and were not needed anymore, and they wanted to add new revolutionary courses. Heated debates had ensued in that packed meeting as drama students demanded that Aeschylus, Shakespeare, and Racine be replaced with Brecht and Gorky, as well as some Marx and Engels. Revolutionary theory was more important than plays. The faculty had all sat on the platform in the hall, except for this particular professor who stood at the back by the door. In a nod to democracy, it was asked if anyone disapproved of the new proposal. From the back of the room, a voice said quietly, "I disagree." A silence fell over the room. The voice gave as his reason his conviction that as far as he was concerned, there was no one, and he meant no one, certainly no revolutionary leader or political hero more important than Racine. What he could teach was Racine. If they did not want to know about Racine, that was up to them. Whenever they decided they wanted to run a proper university and reinstate Racine, then he would be happy to come back and teach. Heads turned abruptly towards the voice in disbelief. It was the impertinent magician. Some started to attack him and his formalist and decadent views. They claimed his ideas were old-fashioned and that he should get with the times. A girl rose and tried to calm the cries of indignation. She said, "This professor always had the students' best interests at heart and that he should be given a chance to defend himself." Later, when I told him the story as I heard it, he corrected me. He had started to talk from the back, but was asked to go to the podium. He had walked to the podium in the silence that had already put him on trial. When he spoke again, it was to say that he felt one single film by Laurel and Hardy was worth more than all their revolutionary tracts, including those of Marx and Lenin. What they called passion was not passion, not even madness. It was some coarse emotion not worthy of true literature. He said that if they changed the curriculum, he would refuse to teach. True to his word, he never did go back, although he participated in the vigils against the closing of the universities. He wanted his students to know that his withdrawal that day was not out of fear of government reprisal. I was told that he almost imprisoned himself in his apartment, meeting with a select group of friends and disciples. "I bet he'd see you, Professor," one of my students said eagerly. I was not so sure. 21. The last day we gave to Gatsby was in January. Heavy snow had covered the streets. There were two images I wanted my students to discuss. I no longer have my battered Gatsby with me, the one with cryptic notes in the margins and at the end of book. When I left Iran, I left my precious books behind. This Gatsby is new, published in 1993. The cover is unfamiliar, and I don't know how to treat it. I began by saying, I would like to begin with a quote from Fitzgerald that is central to our understanding, not just of Gatsby, but of Fitzgerald's whole body of work. I went on to say, we have been talking about what Gatsby is all about, and we've mentioned some themes, but there is an overall undercurrent to the novel which I think determines its essence, and that is the question of loss, the loss of an illusion. Nick disapproves of all the people with whom Gatsby is in one way or another involved, but he does not pass the same judgment on Gatsby. Why? Because Gatsby possesses what Fitzgerald in his story Absolution calls the honesty of imagination. At this point, Mr. Niazi's hand shot up. But Gatsby is even more dishonest than all the others, he squealed. He earns his money through unlawful activities and he consorts with criminals. In a sense, you're right, I said. Gatsby fakes everything, even his own name. All the other characters in the novel have more stable positions and identities. Gatsby is constantly being made and remade by others. At all of his parties, most of his guests speculate in conspiratorial whispers about who he is and the fabulous or awful deeds he has committed. Tom sets out to investigate his true identity, and Nick himself is curious about the mysterious Jay Gatsby. Yet what Gatsby inspires is curiosity tinged with awe. The reality of Gatsby's life is that he's a charlatan. But the truth is that he is a romantic and tragic dreamer who becomes heroic because of his belief in his own romantic delusion. Gatsby cannot tolerate the shabbiness of his life. He has, quote, an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness, and some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life. Unquote. He cannot change the world, so he recreates himself according to his dream. Let's see how Nick explains this. He says, Jay Gatsby of West Egg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself. He was a son of God. A phrase which, if it means anything, means just that. And he must be about his father's business, the service of a vast, vulgar, and meretricious beauty. So he invented just the sort of Jay Gatsby that a 17-year-old boy would be likely to invent. And to this conception, he was faithful to the end. Gatsby's loyalty was to his reinvented self, which saw its fulfillment in Daisy's voice. It was to the promises of that self that he remained faithful, to the green light at the end of the dock, not a shabby dream of wealth and prosperity. Thus the colossal illusion is born, for which he sacrifices his life. As Fitzgerald puts it, no amount of fire or freshness can challenge what a man will store up in his ghostly heart. Gatsby's loyalty to Daisy is linked to his loyalty to his imagined idea of himself. Nick says he talked a lot about the past, and I gathered that he wanted to recover something, some idea of himself perhaps that had gone into loving Daisy. His life had been confused and disordered since then, but if he could once return to a certain starting place and go over it all slowly, he could find out what that thing was. The dream, however, remains incorruptible and it extends beyond Gatsby and his personal life. It exists in a broader sense in the city, in New York itself, and the East, the harbor that once became the dream of hundreds of thousands of immigrants and is now the Mecca of Midwesterners who came to it in search of a new life and thrills. While the city evokes enchanted dreams and half-promises, in reality, it harbors shabby love affairs and relationships such as Tom and Myrtle's. The city, like Daisy, has in it a promise, a mirage that when reached becomes debased and corrupted. The city is the link between Gatsby's dream and the American dream. The dream is not about money, but what he imagines he can become. It is not a comment on America as a materialistic society, but as an idealistic one, one that has turned money into means of retrieving a dream. There's nothing crass here, or the crassness is so mingled with the dream that it becomes very difficult to differentiate between the two. In the end, the best ideals and the most sordid of realities all come together. Could you please turn to the last page? You remember that this is Nick's last goodbye to Gatsby's house. Mr. Bahri, I see you have honored us with your presence today. Could you kindly read the passage, third line in the paragraph, beginning with most of the big shore places? Mr. Bahri read, "And as the moon rose higher, the inessential houses began to melt away until gradually I became aware of the old island here that flowered once for Dutch sailors' eyes, a fresh green breast of the new world. Its vanished trees, the trees that had made way for Gatsby's house, had once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all human dreams. For a transitory, enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder." Mr. Bahri asked, "Shall I read on?" I said, "Please continue until the end of the next paragraph." He went on. "And as I sat there brooding on the old unknown world, I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first picked out the green light at the end of Daisy's dock. He had come a long way to this blue lawn, and his dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it. He did not know that it was already behind him, somewhere back in that vast obscurity beyond the city where the dark fields of the Republic rolled on under the night. He could be dishonest in life, and he could lie about himself, but one thing he could not do was to betray his own imagination. Gatsby is ultimately betrayed by the honesty of his imagination. He dies, for in reality, no such person can survive. We, the readers like Nick, both approve and disapprove of Gatsby. We are more certain of what we disapprove of than of what we admire, for like Nick, we are caught in the romantic implications of his dream. His story reverberates with the tales of the pioneers who came to the shores of America in search of a new land and a new future, and of their dream, already tainted with the violence that had gone into making it real. Gatsby should have never tried to possess his dream, I explained. Even Daisy knows this. She's as much in love with him as she can ever be, and yet she cannot go against her own nature and not betray him. One autumn night, they stop at a place where we are told the sidewalk was white with moonlight. Out of the corner of his eye, Gatsby saw that the blocks of the sidewalk really formed a ladder and mounted to a secret place above the trees. He could climb to it if he climbed alone, and once there, he could suck on the pap of life, gulp down the incomparable milk of wonder. His heart beat faster and faster as Daisy's white face came up to his own. He knew that when he kissed this girl and forever wed his unutterable visions to her perishable breath, his mind would never romp again like the mind of God. I said, "Now could you kindly turn to page 8, read from No, Gatsby." Mr. Bahri read, "No, Gatsby turned out all right at the end. It is what preyed on Gatsby, what foul dust floated in the wake of his dreams, that temporarily closed out my interest in the abortive sorrows and short-winded elations of men." For Gatsby, access to wealth is a means to an end. It is a means to the possession of his dream. That dream removes from him the power to differentiate between imagination and reality. He tries to create a fairyland out of, quote, foul dust. His reveries for a while, quote, provided an outlet for his imagination. They were a satisfactory hint of the unreality of reality, a promise that the rock of the world was founded securely on a fairy's wing, end of quote. So now let us review all the points we have discussed. Yes, the novel is about concrete living relationships, a man's love for a woman's betrayal of that love. But it is also about wealth, its great attraction as well as its destructive power, the carelessness that comes with it, and yes, it is about the American dream, a dream of power and wealth, the beguiling light of Daisy's house and the port of entry to America. It is also about loss, about the perishability of dreams once they are transformed into hard reality. It is the longing, its immateriality, that makes the dream pure. What we in Iran had in common with Fitzgerald was this dream that became our obsession and took over our reality, this terrible, beautiful dream, impossible in its actualization, for which any amount of violence might be justified or forgiven. This was what we had in common, although we were not aware of it then. Dreams, Mr. Niazi, are perfect ideals, completing themselves. How can you impose them on a constantly changing, imperfect, incomplete reality? You would become a Humbert, destroying the object of your dream, or a Gatsby, destroying yourself. When I left the class that day, I did not tell them what I myself was just beginning to discover, how similar our own fate was becoming to Gatsby's. He wanted to fulfill his dream by repeating the past, and in the end he discovered that the past was dead, the present a sham, and there was no future. Was this not similar to our revolution, which had come in the name of our collective past and had wrecked our lives in the name of a dream? 22. After the class, I felt exhausted. I tried to leave quickly, pretending I had some important business at hand. In fact, I had nothing to do. I put on my coat and hat and gloves and left. I had nowhere to go. It snowed heavily that afternoon, and then the sun came out over piles of clean, fresh white snow. When I was very young, before I was sent to England, I had a friend, a childhood friend I loved a great deal. She was older than me. She and I would sometimes walk in the snow for a long time. We would walk to our favorite pastry shop where they had amazing cream puffs made with real cream. We bought the cream puffs and went back out into the snow, in whose protective gleam we ate them as we talked nonsense and walked and walked. I left the university and started to walk past a book-lined street. The street vendors selling tapes had turned up the volume, and they hopped from one foot to the other to keep warm, their woolen hats pulled low over their ears, steam escaping from their mouths and appearing to rise with the sound of the music, rising and disappearing into the blue sky. I walked down the street until the bookstores gave way to other shops, and to a movie house where we used to go as children that was now closed. So many movie houses were burned down during those jubilant days of the revolution. I continued down the street until I came to a square called Ferdowsi, named after our greatest epic poet, and paused. Was it on this spot that my friend and I had stopped to laugh that day as we licked our cream puffs? As the years went by, the snow became polluted with the increasing pollution of Tehran. My friend was now in exile, and I had come home. Until then, home had been amorphous and elusive. It presented itself in tantalizing glimpses with the impersonal familiarity of old family photographs. But all of these feelings belonged to the past. Home was constantly changing before my eyes. I had a feeling that day that I was losing something, that I was mourning a death that had not yet occurred. I felt as if all things personal were being crushed like small wildflowers to make way for a more ornate garden where everything would be tame and organized. I had never felt this sense of loss when I was a student in the States. In all those years, my yearning was tied to the certainty that home was mine for the having, that I could go back any time I wished. It was not until I had reached home that I realized the true meaning of exile. As I walked those dearly beloved, dearly remembered streets, I felt I was squashing the memories that lay underfoot. 23. The spring semester started ominously. From the very beginning, there were few classes. For the past year, the government had been preoccupied with suppressing opposition groups, closing down the progressive newspapers and magazines, punishing former government functionaries, and carrying on a war against the minorities, especially the Kurds. Now it turned its attention towards the universities, hotbeds of dissent, where the Muslim revolutionaries did not hold power. The universities played the role of the now banned newspapers in protesting the suppression of progressive forces. Almost daily, a protest meeting, talk, or demonstration was organized at one of the universities, especially the University of Tehran. One morning, as I entered the department building, I could sense that something was wrong. An enlarged photograph of Hashemi Rafsanjani, who at the time was the Speaker of the Parliament, was pasted to the wall opposite the entrance. Beside it was a flyer alerting students to a conspiracy to shut down the universities. Beneath the photograph and the warning, a large half-circle of students had formed, which seemed to contain smaller half-circles within it. As I drew closer, the students, some of whom I recognized as my own, made way and opened the space for me, in the middle of which I found Mr. Niazi arguing heatedly with one of the leaders of a leftist student organization. Mr. Niazi was vehemently denying that the government had any intention of closing down the universities. The other student pointed to Mr. Rafsanjani's speech at Mashhad University about the need to purify the educational system and to trigger a cultural revolution in the universities. They went back and forth for some time, encouraged by murmurs from the crowd surrounding them. I did not stay to the end of the arguments. It seemed clear that there wouldn't be any. In those days, the secular and leftist forces dominated the universities, and certain developments were not yet conceivable to some of us. To think that the universities could be closed down seemed as far-fetched as the possibility that women would finally succumb to wearing the veil. It did not take long, however, for the government to announce its intention to suspend classes and to form a committee for the implementation of the Cultural Revolution. This committee was given the power to reconstruct the universities in such a way as to make them acceptable to the leaders of the Islamic Republic. What they wanted was not very clear, but they had no doubt as to what they didn't want. They were given the power to expel undesirable faculty, staff, and students, to create a new set of rules and a new curriculum. It was the first organized effort to purge Iran of what was called decadent Western culture. The majority of students and faculty did not give in to this dictate. And once more, the University of Tehran became the scene of a battle. Going to classes became more impossible every day. We were all frantically shuffling from one meeting to another, as if by force of sheer movement we would be able to stop them. The faculty marched and the students marched. There were many disagreements between the various student organizations. The students convened demonstrations and sit-ins. I went to these demonstrations, although I felt no affinity at this point toward any particular organization. If the leftists had come to power, they would have done the same thing. This, of course, was not the point. The point was to save the university, which, like Iran, we had all had a hand in destroying. 24. And so began a new cycle of violent demonstrations. We would start marching, usually in front of the University of Tehran, and as we moved, the crowd would increase. We marched towards the poorer areas, and usually at a narrow alley or a particular intersection, they would come, attacking us with knives and clubs. The demonstrators would disperse only to reorganize quietly farther up the street. We walked the meandering streets and unpaved winding alleys, and suddenly they would come again and attack us at the point of another intersection with their knives drawn, and we would run again, and again we would meet at some other point a few blocks away. I remember one day particularly well. I had left home early with Bijan. He dropped me off near the university on his way to work. A few blocks before the university, I noticed a group, mainly young people, carrying signs and walking towards campus. I noticed Nasreen, whom I had not seen for a few weeks. She had some leaflets in her hand and was walking in the front row. At a certain street corner, she and another girl separated from the group and turned into the street. I suddenly remembered that Nasreen had never given me her promised paper on Gatsby. She had dropped out of my life as suddenly as she had entered it. I wondered if I would ever see her again. I found myself walking with a group of chanting students who had appeared magically. Suddenly, we heard the sound of bullets, which seemed to be coming out of nowhere. The bullets were real. One moment, we were standing in front of the wide iron gate of the university, and then I found myself running towards the bookstores, most of which had closed because of the unrest. I took cover under the awning of one that was still open. Nearby, a music vendor had left his tape deck running, some singer's mournful voice lamenting his love's betrayal. That whole day was one long nightmare. I had no sense of time or place and felt myself joining groups that sooner or later dispersed, drifting from one street to another. In the afternoon, a large demonstration was convened. It soon became the bloodiest confrontation between students and the government. The government had bussed workers in from different factories, in addition to its usual goons and thugs and militia, arming them with batons and knives to stage a counter-demonstration against the students. The workers were chosen because of the leftists' idealization of the proletariat as their natural allies. Once the guns started to fire, we all ran in different directions. I remember at one point, I ran into a former classmate of mine, my best friend from sixth grade, in fact. In the midst of gunshots and chants, we hugged and chatted about the almost 2 decades since we had last seen each other. She told me everyone was moving towards the hospital near the University of Tehran, where the bodies of murdered and wounded students were supposedly being kept. Somehow I lost her in the crowd and found myself alone on the grounds of the large hospital whose name had recently been changed from Pahlavi, the name of the last Shah, to Imam Khomeini. The rumor now was that the police and guards had stolen the bodies of murdered students in order to prevent the news of their death from getting out. The students wanted to storm the hospital to stop the transfer of bodies. I walked towards the main building, and now in my memory, I seem to be forever walking towards that building, never quite reaching it. I was walking in a trance, with people running towards me as well as in the opposite direction. Everyone seemed to have a purpose, some destination in mind, except me. I was walking alone. Suddenly coming towards me, I saw a familiar face. It was Mahtab. At that moment, as I looked at her, paralyzed and frozen, she looked more than anything else like a lost animal in danger. Perhaps it was shock that forced her to walk in a straight line, almost mechanically, and not swerve to the left or right, keeping near perfect balance. Imagine Mahtab walking towards me. Two girls block my view, and then she appears, wearing a loose beige shirt over jeans. She moves into my line of vision, and our eyes meet. She was prepared to pass me by, but she stopped for a short second. So there we were, the two of us, sharing a moment in our ghastly search. She paused to inform me that they had managed to hijack the bodies from the hospital morgues. No one knew where the bodies had been transferred. She said this and disappeared. And I did not see her for another 7 years. As I stood there alone on the hospital grounds with people rushing around me, I had a strange experience. I felt as if my heart had been torn from my body and had landed with a thump in an empty space, a vast void that I did not know existed. I felt tired and frightened. The fear was not of bullets. They were too immediate. I was scared of some lack, as if the future were receding from me. 25. The students kept a vigil on the grounds of the university to prevent it from closing down. They kept their vigil until in what almost amounted to a bloody battle, although the government forces were the only ones with guns, they were evacuated and the militia, the Revolutionary Guards, and the police conquered the university grounds. It was during one of these vigils that I saw Mr. Bahri. The night was filled with anxiety as well as the false coziness of such events as we sat on the ground in close proximity exchanging jokes, information, or stories, sometimes arguing away the pleasantly warm nights. He was standing alone in a dark corner, leaning against a tree. "So what do you think of this?" I asked him. He smiled a precocious smile and said, "No, ma'am. What do you think?" "Mr. Bahri," I said slowly, "what I think is becoming increasingly irrelevant. So irrelevant, in fact, that I think I will go home, grab a good book, and try to get some sleep." I knew I had startled him, but I had also startled myself. All of a sudden, I felt as if this was not my fight. For most of those present, the excitement of the battle meant almost everything. And I was not excited, not in that way. Did it matter to me who closed the university down? Whether it was my leftist students or the Islamic ones? What mattered was that the university should not be closed at all, that it should be allowed to function as a university and not become a battleground for different political forces. But it took me a long time, in fact, 17 more years, to finally digest and formulate this understanding. For the time being, I went home. Soon after that, the government managed to shut down the universities. They purged the faculty, students, and staff. Some students were killed or jailed. Others simply disappeared. The University of Tehran had become the seat of too much disappointment, too much sorrow and hurt. Never again would I rush so innocently, so eagerly to a class as I did in those days at the dawn of the revolution. 26. One day in the spring of 1981, I can still feel the sun and the morning breeze on my cheeks, I became irrelevant. Just over a year after I had returned to my country, my city, my home, I discovered that the same decree that had transformed the single word Iran into the Islamic Republic of Iran had made me and all that I had been irrelevant. The fact that I shared this fate with many others did not help much. In fact, I had become irrelevant sometime before then. After the so-called cultural revolution that led to the closing down of universities, I was essentially out of a job. We went to the university, but we had nothing much to do. I took to writing a diary and reading Agatha Christie. I roamed the streets with my American reporter, talking about Mike Gold's Lower East Side and Fitzgerald's West Egg. Instead of classes, we were summoned to endless meetings. The administration wanted us to stop working and at the same time to pretend that nothing had changed. Although the universities were closed, the faculty was required to be present and to offer projects to the Committee on the Cultural Revolution. These were idle days, whose only enduring feature was the lasting friendships we formed with colleagues in our own and other departments. I was the youngest and newest addition to the group and had a great deal to learn. They told me about the pre-revolutionary days, about excitement and hope. They talked about some of their colleagues who had never returned. The newly elected Committee for the Implementation of the Cultural Revolution visited the Faculty of Law and Political Sciences and the Faculty of Persian and Foreign Languages and Literature at the auditorium in the School of Law. Despite the formal and informal instructions to the female faculty and staff on the issue of the veil, until that day most women at our university had not obeyed the new rules. That meeting was the first I had attended at which all the female participants wore headscarves. All, that is, except three: Farideh, Lale, and me. We were independent and considered eccentric. So the three of us went to that meeting unveiled. The three members of the Committee on the Cultural Revolution sat rather uncomfortably on the very high stage. Their expressions were by turns haughty, nervous, and defiant. That meeting was the last at the University of Tehran in which the faculty openly criticized the government and its politics regarding higher education. Most were rewarded for their impertinence by being expelled. Faride, Lale, and I sat together conspicuously, like naughty children. We whispered, we consulted one another, we kept thrusting our hands up to talk. Faride took the committee to task for using the university grounds to torture and intimidate the students. I told the revolutionary committee that my integrity as a teacher and a woman was being compromised by its insistence that I wear the veil under false pretenses for a few thousand tumans a month. The issue was not so much the veil itself as freedom of choice. My grandmother had refused to leave the house for 3 months when she was forced to unveil. I would be similarly adamant in my refusal. Little did I know that I would soon be given the choice of either veiling or being jailed, flogged, and perhaps killed if I disobeyed. After that meeting, one of my more pragmatic colleagues, a modern woman who decided to take up the veil and stayed there for another 17 years after I was gone, told me with a hint of sarcasm in her voice, "You are fighting a losing battle. Why lose your job over an issue like this? In another couple of weeks, you will be forced to wear the veil in the grocery stores." The simplest answer, of course, was that the university was not a grocery store. But she was right. Soon we would be forced to wear it everywhere. And the morality squads, with their guns and Toyota patrols, would guard the streets to ensure our adherence. On that sunny day, however, when my colleagues and I made our protest known, these incidents did not seem to be preordained. So much of the faculty protested. We thought we might yet win. We left the meeting with a feeling of jubilance. The committee had clearly been defeated. Their responses had been lame, and as the meeting progressed, they became more incoherent and defensive. When we emerged from the assembly hall, Mr. Bahri was waiting for me with a friend. He did not talk to my other colleagues, but directed all his comments towards me. He did not understand it. How could I do this? Were we not friends? Yes, we were friends, but this really wasn't personal, not in that way. Don't you see? You are unconsciously helping the enemy, the imperialists, he said mournfully. Is it too much to ask you to comply with a few rules to save the revolution? I could have asked him whose revolution, but I didn't. Faride, Lale, and I were too euphoric, and we were going out to lunch to celebrate. A few months after that, committees were established that led to the purging of some of the best faculty and students. Dr. A would resign and leave for the United States. Faride would be expelled and later would go to Europe. The bright young professor whom I had met that first day in Dr. A's office was also expelled in due time. I met him 11 years later at a conference in Austin, Texas. Of the old group, only Lale and I would remain, and soon we too would be expelled. The government would make the veil mandatory and put more students and faculty members on trial. I went to one more demonstration, called by the Mujahideen, but supported by all the opposition forces, except the Communist Tudeh Party and the Fadaiyan organization. By then, the first president of the republic was in hiding and would soon flee the country. Over 500,000 participated in what turned out to be one of the bloodiest battles of the revolution. Over 1,000 people were arrested, many including teenagers executed on the spot. 8 days later, on June 28, the Islamic Party's headquarters were bombed, and over 80 of its members and top leaders in the government were killed. The government took revenge by executing and arresting individuals almost randomly. Oddly, when the university administration began the process of my dismissal, it was not secular colleagues, but Mr. Bahri and his friends, former students who almost all got Fs that semester for not attending classes, who defended me and delayed my expulsion for as long as they could. The feelings I thought I had left behind returned when almost 19 years later, the Islamic regime would once again turn against its students. This time, it would open fire on those it had admitted to the universities, those who were its own children, the children of the revolution. Once more, my students would go to the hospitals in search of the murdered bodies that were stolen by the guards and vigilantes and try to prevent them from stealing the wounded. Only this time, I was walking those grounds in my imagination as I read faxes and emails in my office in Washington, D.C., from my former students in Iran, trying to decipher something beyond the hysteria of their words. I would like to know where Mr. Bahri is right now, at this moment, and to ask him, how did it all turn out, Mr. Bahri? Was this your dream of the revolution? Who will pay for all those ghosts in my memory? Who will pay for the snapshots of the murdered and the executed that we hid in our shoes and closets as we moved on to other things? Tell me, Mr. Bahri, or to use that odd expression of Gatsby's, tell me, old sport, what shall we do with all these corpses on our hands?